IP Fridays, Episode 5.
This is Elizabeth King of Conley Rose in Houston, Texas, and you are listening to IPFridays.com.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of IP Fridays. Our names are Ken Suzanne and Rolf Clayson, and this is the podcast dedicated to intellectual property. It does not matter where you are from, in-house or private practice, novice or expert. We will help you stay up to date with current topics in the fields of trademarks, patents, design and copyright, discover useful tools, and much more.
Thank you very much for tuning in to the fifth episode of IP Fridays. We are very excited that we already have 1,000 downloads of MP3 files for our episodes. Thank you very much. And we have exciting things to share today. We will hear about Facebook drones. We have an interview with Elizabeth King about non-traditional trademarks. And we talk about the Redskins. And as a matter of fact, we talk about the Redskins right now. Ken, can you tell us more about the Redskins?
Ralph, the Washington Redskins began as a professional football team in the very early days of football, in the year 1932. The team registered its Redskins name as a trademark in the 1960s, and continues to use the name to this day on official team merchandise. However, many consider the name to be a derogatory and offensive reference to Native Americans. In spite of public backlash, the owner of the Redskins, Dan Snyder, has publicly stated his unwillingness to consider a change to the team's name. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, himself a childhood Redskins fan, has backed Snyder's decision. The team has also faced resistance to its trademark rights in the Redskins' name. Section 2A of the United States Trademark Act disallows the registration of trademarks that disparage persons, institutions, or beliefs, or brings them into contempt or disrepute. Believing the Redskins' name to be disparaging, a group of Native Americans in 1992 sought cancellation of the Redskins' trademark in front of the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board, or TTAB, the body of the United States Patent and Trademark Office that handles trademark registration challenges. After 7 years of litigation, the TTAB found the trademark to be disparaging under the Trademark Act and canceled its registration. A drawn-out appeals process followed, in which the challengers were eventually found to have delayed too long in bringing suit against the Redskins trademark. Now, a second and younger group of Native American challengers has come forward, and the TTAB has once again decided the Redskins trademark should be canceled due to the disparaging nature of the Redskins term. The 81-page majority opinion issued by the TTAB on June 18th relied upon expert opinions and resolutions by Native American tribes to find that not only has the term Redskins retained its meaning as a name for a Native American individual, but that the Redskins' name is collectively found disparaging and offensive by a substantial composite of Native Americans. The TTAB found the Latches defense earlier relied upon by the Redskins to be inapplicable. The Redskins can still continue to enforce their trademark pending appeal of the TTAB decision, which will likely be a lengthy process. The appeal of the earlier TTAB cancellation went on for a decade. If the cancellation is upheld on appeal, the Redskins may continue to use the mark on their merchandise, but they will have much more of a difficult time in preventing others from also marketing and selling merchandise under the Redskins' name. The decision also addressed only the use of the name itself and some old designs incorporating the name, and did not affect the current logo used by the team. Whether this decision can convince the NFL and Dan Snyder to change the team's name remains to be seen, but opponents see further evidence of the need for a new team name in Washington. As Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said in his reaction to the decision, quote, "The writing is on the wall in giant blinking neon lights."
Thank you very much, Ken. this case got a lot of press. So if you want to know more about this, you can go to www.ipfridays.com/redskins, www.ipfridays.com/redskins, or just visit the show notes for this episode. Recently, during the INTA meeting in Hong Kong, I met Elizabeth King, who is really into non-traditional trademarks. And I'm very glad I was able to secure a time slot in her very busy schedule for the following interview. Thank you very much, Elizabeth King. I'm sitting here with Elizabeth King of Conley Rose. She's partner with the firm, and I met her at the INTA meeting in Hong Kong. And I'm very happy that she is willing to give an interview for our podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And why don't you tell our listeners a little more about yourself?
Well, thank you again for having me. I am a trademark lawyer in the United States. As you said, I am a shareholder with the Houston-based intellectual property firm of Conley Rose. I have been practicing law for over 20 years, and I dedicate my practice to trademarks. And the last few years, I've had a special interest and focus on non-traditional trademarks.
So tell me more about what actually a non-traditional trademark is.
Okay, yeah, that's a great question. So basically, when you think about trademarks, you usually think about the name that you use to call for a particular item, goods or services. For example, if you want a beverage, you might say, I want a Coke, or you may say, I want a Pepsi. And that's generally how we think of trademarks being. So we usually think of them as words or combinations of words or logos. But what a non-traditional mark is basically almost everything else. It can be a color. It can be a combination of colors. It can be a product design itself, like the actual product itself functions as a trademark. It can be packaging for the product. Sometimes you have products that you could look at as either packaging or product design, and then you have to sort of decide which way you want to go. They can also be shapes. They can be motions. They can be sounds. They can be holograms. They just essentially have to meet the hurdle of not conferring what I would call an unfair competitive advantage against others, and also functioning as a trademark, meaning functioning as a source indicator.
So if any of my applicants would like to file a non-traditional trademark in the US, like what would you recommend? Like, can they have a broad scope of protection, or should they file it with a narrow definition, or what would be prudent if they want to enforce the trademark later on against competitors, and when can they enforce this?
Well, those are really very good questions. And it's actually been a very important subject for me in my research and writing lately, because my first piece of advice to any non-traditional mark holder is to not overreach. I think it's very important when you're drafting a non-traditional trademark application with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office that you tightly define what you are seeking to protect. If you're seeking colors, I think you need to specify those colors with a color range. If you're seeking packaging or a product design, you need to be very careful, particularly with the latter, with product design, of showing enough evidence of what's called acquired distinctiveness as a mark, because under U.S. law, product design can never be inherently distinctive. The other thing you have to be very, very careful about, particularly if you own color trademarks, is that you need to be very, very circumspect in discerning between when another party's use of color is mere ornamentation, meaning they're just using these colors decoratively, versus when they are actually trying to infringe on your trademark rights. I think a perfect example of a case where a trademark frankly, was were an application for trademark protection and the subsequently issued registration was far too broad, was the original Christian Louboutin Red Souls registration. And that registration was frankly unenforceable as issued. There was no narrowing of the color range. In my view, that was an important thing that should have happened. And there was no contrast of the red sole with the different colored upper. And further to that thought, I strongly feel that when Yves Saint Laurent, which came out with one of its monochromatic color lines, which was not even really the same color red, started using it, my belief is that a lot could have been avoided in terms of litigation costs had there been a more careful assessment about whether or not that use of the color red by Yves Saint Laurent was in fact just ornamental, meaning this wasn't, I mean, it was pretty clear from the facts of the case, in my view, that this wasn't an attempt to infringe on any trademark rights held by Christian Louboutin. This was merely a fashion designer in the industry using the color red as a ornamentation for one of their cruise lines, which they had done many, many times in the past, and something that somebody in Louboutin's position probably should have known. So what does all this mean? What is the takeaway of all this? Well, once that case went up to the Second Circuit in New York, the court basically modified the original Louboutin registration to say that, you know, well, at a minimum, you're going to need to have this red contrast with this other color upper on the shoe. Once the registration was modified, the Second Circuit didn't get to the issue of what in U.S. law is called the functionality doctrine. They basically said, we don't need to decide whether or not you having a registration on the single color red in the fashion industry is giving you an unfair competitive advantage, which would be precluded under Section 2E5 of the U.S. Trademark Act. We don't need to decide that because based on the modification of the registration we've just done, we find no confusing similarity between your mark and the YSL use, and therefore there's no confusion as a matter of law, and we don't need to even get to this other issue of functionality. At the end of the day, how could it have been different? Well, in my view, it could have been different if the registration itself were very tightly drafted. If the mark had been very tightly described within the original application so that it would be very clear that there's not any overreaching as far as what's being claimed as a protectable mark. The second thing is, I think, a little bit more deliberation. If you happen to, in my view, have the wonderful fortune of actually having an enforceable non-traditional mark, which is very, very difficult to develop. But if you've actually developed one, I think the most important thing you can do as a mark holder is to be very deliberative and circumspect about in what instances you're going to seek to enforce those trademark rights versus a competitor or somebody, you know, whether they're a direct competitor or they're just offering their goods and services in the same trade channel. Because what happens and what courts don't like is when you become overly aggressive with a non-traditional mark, and you try to say, okay, well, I own, you know, these two or three colors, and so now no one in my industry can ever use these colors together or they're infringing. Well, that's really not necessarily true. There's going to be times when another person's use is completely okay because it's just ornamentation. And they're not attempting to confuse the public into believing that they are you. Mm-hmm. So you have to sort of, in my view, you take a step back if you own a non-traditional mark and you have to look at someone else's usage, particularly if it's color. I mean, this is particularly the case in the instances of single colors or multiple colors. And you have to look at that other party's use and really think forward about whether or not it looks like you're being unfair and trying to corner all uses of color, whether they're ornamental or not, because there's going to be some cases where someone is clearly trying to pass themselves off as you, and they're adopting your colors as a result of that, as part of that plan, I should say. And in that instance, yes, having that federal registration for your colors is great because you can shut that use, that infringing use down. But in other instances, it's going to be very clear that there's no attempt to infringe, that there's no intent whatsoever, and there is no infringement, and that this usage is merely ornamentation. And in that case, obviously, the right thing to do is to keep your head down and your mouth shut and move forward. And that's, quite honestly, responsible trademark practicing. And the reason I think that this sort of underlying strategy is so important in the United States is because, much like Europe, we have a fundamental aversion to the idea of people owning non-traditional trademarks. Under U.S. law, we want people to be able to copy designs. We want people to be able to freely use color and other aspects of ornamentation. We don't want, you know, we have the patent law, which will convey exclusivity for, you know, 20 years or whatever, if it's a design patent, a little less than that. But that exclusivity ends at a finite period of time, and then that invention goes into the public domain. But trademarks never expire. So if you have a non-traditional trademark, and it is, in fact, a valid non-traditional trademark, that never expires. So what that means is that forever, under the United States law, no one can make that, for example, product design ever. And so as a result of that, it is very, very difficult to prove that by you having the exclusive right to that design or that color or whatever it is, sound, that you are not unfairly hindering competition. It's okay if your trademark, that's either a product design or packaging or color or what shapes, whatever it is, it's okay if it gives you a competitive advantage. It cannot give you an unfair competitive advantage. It cannot be cheaper to make. It cannot make your product or your services of higher quality. It cannot be cheaper to make. It cannot be easier to use. It cannot affect the quality of the item or the services in a way that benefits you vis-a-vis the competition. If any of those things are in place, then you're going to be precluded from trademark protection as a matter of law, regardless of whether or not your product design or your packaging or whatever actually functions as a trademark.
So you're saying non-traditional trademarks with an unfair advantage for the holders, mm-hmm. Can they be compared to generic marks?
Well, very, very rarely can they. The only time a product design or another type of non-traditional mark that's alleged to be a mark by a mark holder would be similar to generic is when that particular design does not function as a trademark. But actually, this is a very big misconception in the law, which is that generics are similar to non-traditional marks that are precluded from protection under Section 2E5 of the Act, which is called the functionality doctrine. Actually, nothing could be further from the truth. The reason that that's a false analogy is because generic terms fail to operate as trademarks as a matter of fact. If you hear it, you do not think of it as a source indicator. In contrast, a non-traditional mark that is barred under the functionality doctrine many times may operate as an indicator of source, but it's precluded from trademark protection as a matter of law. So it may very well be recognized as a mark, but because it confers an unfair competitive advantage to the mark holder, they get no protection as a matter of law. So that's one of the misconceptions between those two concepts that is out there that I think, quite honestly, further conflates the issue in this really esoteric area of the law.
Thank you very much. This is very interesting for our listeners, not only the listeners outside the US, but maybe even many listeners inside the US. Thank you very much.
Well, I really thank you very much for having me.
So what do our listeners do if they want to learn more about you?
Oh, well, they can go to my firm's website, which is www.conleyrose.com. That's conleyrose.com. Or they can shoot me an email. I'm at eking@conleyrose.com. And I'd love to hear from anybody who wants to reach out and discuss this, what is, I think, a really fascinating area of trademark law.
Elizabeth, thank you very, very much for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
If you want to visit her website, just go to www.ipfridays.com/Elizabeth King. www.ipfridays.com/Elizabeth King. So next, we want to give you more information about the recent developments with Facebook drones. Ken, can you fill in our listeners?
Ralph, Facebook, the multi-billion dollar social networking conglomerate, is branching out into uncharted territory, both metaphorically and literally. The Menlo Park, California-based company recently filed a trademark application with the United States Patent and Trademark Office to register its name in connection with unmanned aerial vehicles, more commonly known as drones. The application is very short and simple. It merely provides that the name Facebook, in plain type, will be somehow be used in connection with drones. The application is filed on an intent-to-use basis, meaning that Facebook does not yet have the trademark in use on the drones. The application also specifies that the Facebook name will be used in connection with a Class 12 good, which includes all vehicles that travel by land, air, or water. The trademark application raises many more questions than it answers. Is Facebook really creating an army of drones with their trademark emblazoned on the sides? Will the drones be watching our every move? And when will the drones start filling the skies? However, this trademark application is likely connected to drones intended not for surveillance, but instead to spread internet access throughout the world. In March of 2014, Facebook purchased a United Kingdom company known as Ascenta that specializes in producing solar-powered drone aircraft. Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook founder and CEO, revealed at that time that Facebook plans to use the Ascenta unmanned aircraft as part of a larger scheme to provide broadband internet connections in rural areas in conjunction with satellites and lasers. This Facebook push for rural internet connectivity is facing direct competition from a similar Google project, as Google recently purchased a competing drone maker and has publicized its Project Loon program that uses balloons to spread internet access. With a push for rural customers and name brand recognition in previously internet-deprived locations, it would make sense for Facebook to want to brand its drones appropriately. One report has shown that only 16% of Africans have used the internet in the past year, compared to 75% of Europeans. Facebook may want to be careful, though. Recent reports on U.S. military drone use show that over 400 drones have crashed since 2001.
If you want to learn more about this issue and read a recent article in the press, you can follow the link at www.ipfridays.com/Facebook drones, ipfridays.com/Facebook drones.
That's it for this episode. If you liked what you heard, please show us your love by visiting ipfridays.com/love and tweet a link to this show. We would be so grateful if you would do that. It would help us out to get the word out. Also, please subscribe to our podcast at ipfridays.com or on iTunes or Stitcher.com. If you have a question or want to be featured in one of the upcoming episodes, please send us your feedback at ipfridays.com/feedback. Also, please leave us a review on iTunes. You can go to ipfridays.com/iTunes, and it will take you right to the correct page on iTunes. If you want to get mentioned on this podcast or even have comments within the next episode, please leave us your voicemail at ipfridays.com/voicemail. You have been listening to an episode of IP Fridays. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by their respective law firms. None of the content should be considered legal advice. The IP Fridays podcast should not be construed as legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The contents of this podcast are intended for general informational purposes only, and you are urged to consult your own lawyer on any specific legal questions. As always, consult a lawyer or patent or trademark attorney. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved.